You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. When you want to know what's happening in the wild places of the tropics, you need to go to mongabay.com. Rhett Butler founded and ran that website and news service starting in 1999. It's gone a lot of places since then, and that includes a Manga Bay project in the Indonesian language. And that may explain why Rhett gets those hard-to-find photos like illegal fires burning in an Indonesian national park. So when Indonesia is on fire, as it is right now, it's a real pleasure to welcome you, Rhett Butler, to Radio EcoShock.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Look, Western environmentalists focus on cutting tailpipe emissions and closing old coal plants. That's important. But we've just seen Indonesia skyrocket almost the number one global source of greenhouse gases, surpassing even the USA, and the cause is not fossil fuels or industry. Rhett, what does this tell us about the new need to protect tropical forests, not just to save exotic animals, but to save ourselves?
Well, right. I mean, that's a good point. So forests are a huge carbon sink, so they store lots of carbon. And so when those forests are cut down and burned, that carbon is released into the atmosphere. So in the case of Indonesia, this activity is particularly damaging because a lot of the forests grow on peat soils. Peat soils are very dense, have very dense organic matter. And when they are drained and then burned, it releases very large amounts of carbon into the atmosphere. And along with that carbon are particulates and other matter that make air pollution very bad. So not only does it help drive the climate change, but it also creates regional and even broader air pollution.
Let's get to some specifics on the ground. Rhett, what are you hearing about the scale of the Indonesian fires this year?
The scale of the fires is truly staggering this year. Typically, fires are lit every year in Indonesia. The difference is that in dry years, the fires can really explode and be out of control. So as your listeners probably know, this is an El Nino year, which means it's very dry in Indonesia. There hasn't been rain for months in some parts of Indonesia. So the result is that these peatlands that have been degraded by oil palm plantations and pulp and paper and other industries are basically a tinderbox. And so when small farmers and land developers lit these fires, they essentially burned out of control. And so now they're spreading into national parks and other forests and releasing massive amounts of carbon, but also this horrendous air pollution, which is really what neighboring countries care about because it's creating all sorts of health risks and transportation problems just because the air pollution is so bad.
Right. They just held a meeting in Vietnam of the ASEAN nations trying to find a solution to this, didn't they?
They did, yeah. So, I mean, this is not a new problem. This problem has been going on for decades, actually. So the last really bad spasm of air pollution or haze, as they call it in Southeast Asia, was in 1997 and 1998. So in that year, somewhere between 8 and 10 million hectares of land burned. So that's 20 to 25 million acres. And that generated this haze that spread all the way from Australia to Thailand and Singapore and Malaysia. And so that caused a lot of problems. There was an airplane crash linked to that. This year so far is stacking up to be very comparable to 1997 and 1998. So there's been a lot of talk for, you know, almost 20 years on this issue, but very little has actually gotten done.
We just had massive wildfires in Western North America this past summer. Ground and air crews rush out to contain them. Does that happen in Indonesia?
It happens on a much different scale. So the resources in Indonesia are much more limited than we would have in the United States or Canada. It's also, the fires are different because they tend to be burning in peatland. So the fires will often burn essentially underground. So it's very difficult to extinguish them. An added complication is there's not much water that's available. So they don't have the financial resources, nor do they actually have the physical water they need to put out these fires, which are, you know, very difficult to extinguish anyway because they're burning underground often. So, you know, these are fires that tend to smolder. You put it out in one area and it will pop up in another area. And then, you know, they can easily move into dense forests, which, you know, since they're dried out, they burn, which is not what they would normally do because we're talking about tropical rainforest here. So it's a very difficult situation to address. And really the only thing that's going to put out these fires is when rain returns. And it's not clear when that's going to happen. Some people are projecting in the next couple weeks. Other people say it won't be until January when there'll be enough rain to really extinguish these fires.
I'm trying to figure out the balance. I mean, some of these fires are set by humans, but they're not evil people necessarily. These are people, poor people, who are trying to clear land to feed themselves or to get some sort of economy going. But there are also major corporations, some of them from outside Indonesia, who are part of this. How do you see that balance?
Yeah, so again, it's a difficult situation. It's not clear cut. It's not like it's just big companies, you know, raising the rainforest to produce palm oil. It's much more complex than that. So in many cases, what it is it's small farmers who are clearing vegetation. The cheapest way to do that is by burning, which humans have done, you know, for thousands of years. And so they're just doing what they've always done, clearing land for agriculture to feed their families, but also to, you know, grow crops to earn some money. But the problem now is that the landscape has been so degraded and so changed that these fires aren't limited to small areas. And so that's where the big companies really come in, because they have converted huge areas of what was once forest and peatlands into this ecosystem that now burns easily and very difficult to extinguish fires, especially when it's dry. So what's different now is that companies have come in and really changed the landscape. It's gone from something where fires would typically be pretty limited in scale to something totally different. And so what these primarily palm oil and pulp and paper companies have done is they've dug these large canals and drained the peatlands. And so when you drain the peatlands, it lowers the water table and the peat becomes very combustible. So essentially what these companies have done is they've created conditions that enable these fires. And so then when small farmers come in and start the fires, they are very difficult to put out. But it's not just people in Indonesia who are causing these fires. We in the West bear some responsibility as well, because we consume the products that are produced from these areas. So, for example, a lot of snack foods in the United States and cosmetics use palm oil. And so palm oil is being produced on these lands that were once forests and peatlands that are now burning. Same with paper. So pulp and paper is a has traditionally been a huge driver of deforestation in this area, and it's helped create these conditions that lead to these fires.
Oh, you've just mentioned two things that really bother me. And one is it's not just the pulp and paper behind deforestation, because you also have companies who are essentially boiling down the rainforest to make cellulose products for clothes. And that's another whole campaign that's been going on, is to try and get clothing manufacturers to be more responsible so that the orangutans aren't paying for some bit of fashion that you get off the runway.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, people, when we talk about timber products and pulp and paper, people forget that a lot of the fabrics that go into clothes are made out of fiber as well. And so this is a concern. And because the fashion industry is, you know, constantly turning over new product, it has a significant environmental impact. And so it also tends to be a place where campaigners can focus, because most people don't want to be associated with destroying orangutan habitat and endangering more species. So a lot of activists see it as an opportunity to try to get big companies to adopt policies that ensure that their sourcing is more responsible. And so that's happening in the fashion industry. It's also happening with the big snack food companies. So that's been an angle to try to encourage better stewardship of forests and peatlands in Indonesia, is by getting these big companies that buy a lot of raw materials to say, okay, we're not going to buy any fiber that's produced at the expense of rainforests.
And then we have palm oil being sold as a green biofuel. I've heard there was a Dutch power plant burning palm oil to be green, but when we see the wreckage on the ground and the carbon emissions that come out from it, it seems like almost a scam to me.
Well, certainly there's a much larger environmental impact from palm oil than most people have been led to believe. And the problem is not so much the palm oil itself, it's how the palm oil is produced. So, you know, traditionally what's happened is that a company will go in and then clear rainforest or peatlands and then convert that area to an oil palm plantation. So traditionally what people have ignored is the fact there's all these emissions from that initial land use conversion. And so if you don't count that, then palm oil looks, you know, kind of green. But if you incorporate all the life cycle emissions from palm oil production, then it's a much less environmentally friendly story.
This is Radio EcoShock. We're talking with Rhett Butler from MongaBay.com, and we're talking about the Indonesian crisis, I would call it, although the central government of Indonesia has refused to call this a disaster, as I understand it.
Right. So they haven't quite, they haven't used that wording yet, but I mean, it certainly is a crisis. I mean, the president of Indonesia, Jokowi, just flew home from, canceled half of his trip to the United States. This is his first visit ever to the U.S. as a president, in order to deal with these fires. So it is a real concern. There, I've seen projections saying that the fires are going to cost $50 billion, which is equivalent to 4% of the Indonesian economy. So it essentially wipes out all this economic growth for the year. And so, you know, while some people may not care about the environment, you know, some policymakers, you know, high-level politicians don't care about so much about the environment. But when you start talking about the economics, then it, you know, becomes a bigger issue. And so a big concern also is kind of the healthcare crisis that's being generated from this. There are 500,000 people who've been hospitalized as a result of the air pollution generated by these fires. So it is a real crisis. Whether it's going to be declared a disaster is kind of a moot point at this stage. It's a very serious problem, that's for sure.
Well, I've seen the central government in Jakarta has banned any further licenses to clear and drain peatlands. But I'm wondering, Rhett, what do you think the chances are that rule can be enforced in the many islands of Indonesia?
Well, so that's always been a challenge. Indonesia has a lot of laws on the books that theoretically produce peatlands. But at the same time, it's very difficult to enforce those laws. You know, obviously, Indonesia is known for its corruption, but you have various levels of government. So that's really been the big challenge. So I guess, you know, the question for people is, while the government hasn't passed any new laws since the haze broke out, will people actually care about this issue 6 months from now when the fires are over? Will there still be the momentum to actually address the fundamental problems that have driven this crisis?
Just another complicating factor, the independence movement in Aceh came out with their own land use plan, and it wasn't very progressive or protective. Have you heard about that?
Yeah, so the spatial plan in Aceh has been very controversial. It's been fought over for probably almost 2 years now. And, you know, the Acehnese government wants to open up huge areas of forest to industrial mining, oil palm concessions, and logging. So the civil war had kind of prevented a lot of that, or I guess postponed a lot of that conversion that had happened in other parts of Sumatra. So Aceh was seen as kind of the last frontier, the last wild area in Indonesia. But the government is very interested in pursuing that development path that, you know, other parts of Sumatra have pursued, and that will result in essentially, you know, wreckage to the forest.
You would think that a sudden jump in emissions would be raised at the Paris climate talks coming up in December, but my understanding is that Indonesia doesn't mention control of tropical fires in their emissions reduction plan. What are the forest preservation people hoping will happen in Paris?
Well, I think these fires have changed the conversation. I mean, it's such a hot topic right now. I can't imagine that there won't be pressure around this once the climate talks start. I know that the U.S. government, Singaporean governments are very concerned about this issue. So I would believe that it's an issue that will be raised and will be at least discussed in some degree. I mean, it's hard to say whether it'll be built into their climate pledge or not, but I honestly don't see how Indonesia could possibly meet its emissions commitment without addressing this fundamental problem.
Will you be going to Paris?
I will not be going to Paris, but Mongabe has three correspondents who will be there, so they'll be covering the action.
Well, we'll look for that. You do operate a new site that's become a hub for vital information. Are there other stories from Indonesia that have caught your attention and maybe make you worry a bit?
Oh, well, there's plenty to worry about in Indonesia right now. So even before the fires, there was huge concern about kind of this backlash against these companies that have adopted zero deforestation commitments. So the government, and, you know, it's a little bit harder to define who in the government, but let's say elements in the government have been very strongly opposed to these zero deforestation commitments. And again, these zero deforestation commitments have emerged as a response to consumers and companies who are concerned about being associated with destructive practices. And so a bunch of U.S., European, Canadian companies have established safeguards for palm oil and other commodity sourcing, which basically says we will not buy palm oil to produce at the expense of rainforest, peatlands, or as a result of human rights abuses. And so these Indonesian companies, several Indonesian companies have adopted these policies, but the Indonesian government is now putting pressure on these companies to not maintain those policies, to, you know, not respect them. And at the same time, there's still a lot of other companies that are not part of those agreements that, you know, sell to other markets, especially domestic markets, that continue to destroy forests. And so that's a very troubling development in that, you know, the big companies that are trying to do the right thing may not be allowed to do the right thing because they'll be pressured by the government.
Are we going to see some species extinctions there the way things are going?
Well, we've already seen some species extinctions in Indonesia. They've lost two species of tiger, the Javan tiger and the Bali tiger. The Sumatran tiger is, you know, the last tiger in Indonesia. It's critically endangered. They estimate around 400 of those. I mean, honestly, I don't think they'll go extinct, but they could definitely be more and more threatened. But really, there's a lot of species that have never been, you know, science has not documented in Indonesia that are probably disappearing. It is a huge concern, and there's just less and less habitat, especially in Sumatra. I mean, Sumatra's forests and peatlands have been just really heavily wrecked by the various plantation industries and these fires.
I'm trying to picture what Indonesia will look like in 2050. I was there in 1990, so that seems like ages ago, and it's changed a lot since then. Will it be stripped of its tropical forests? Will it be one giant agricultural factory feeding other economies? Rhett, what's the worst and the best you can see for Indonesia?
Well, just to provide some context, since you were there in 1990, Sumatra has lost half of its forest cover that existed then.
Wow.
So it's pretty staggering how much has been lost. And so what tends to happen is that once the forest is converted, then it becomes an oil palm plantation or it's left as wasteland. So a lot of the area that's burning right now is essentially wasteland, not used by anyone. It's, you know, just dead. It's not good for anything. And so it's a huge loss. And so, you know, that's happening now, has happened to most of Sumatra. It's spreading into Kalimantan, you know, oil palm, coal mines, timber plantations. And what's really worrying to conservationists and also scientists is what's going to happen in Indonesian New Guinea. So that's the real last frontier now, and it's really being opened up quickly for these projects that have questionable economic value that, you know, will be environmentally and culturally devastating. And so there is serious concern that Indonesia, which is, you know, arguably the most biodiverse country on Earth, could be biologically impoverished in the next, you know, 30 to 40 years if these trends continue.
Unless we could turn it around somehow, and I haven't given up hope for Indonesia, and I know the people of Indonesia haven't either.
Yeah, so, I mean, there are some reasons for hope in Indonesia. I mean, I think, the sad fact is sometimes it takes a crisis for people to really to shock people into action. And I think that this haze could do that. So in 2013, there was also a severe haze. It was not at the level that we're seeing now. But the difference was is the wind patterns pushed a lot of that air pollution over Singapore. And Singapore was not happy about that at all. And so they passed a law which allowed them to sue international companies for causing haze. And so that actually triggered real legislation that's trying to be enforced now. And so I think by that same mechanism, the fact that the haze is so severe right now that it could really force the government and companies to try to address this issue. So that's one important thing. Another is that today we can see more than ever what's actually happening on the ground. So there's this amazing platform called Global Forest Watch, which aggregates all different sorts of forest data from around the world, from satellites to on-the-ground information. And that's really giving us a much better idea of what's happening. And so, you know, there's a potential for companies to essentially get, you know, blacklisted or just develop a really bad reputation because we can see that within their concessions that they're chopping down forests. So it's a new way to pressure companies. Another major development has been the government's new willingness to look at traditional land rights. And so a lot of the forests that remain in Indonesia are essentially belong to communities, so they're managed by communities. But the problem has been that the government hasn't recognized the rights of those communities, and so there would be a community forest. The government would then grant a concession to a logging or a plantation company. That company would come in and basically take that forest away from the communities, cut it down, and convert it for, you know, the plantation. But if the traditional rights are recognized, then there's hope that those forests can be protected instead of being converted. There's certainly some positive developments. I think a model that Indonesia is very interested in is what's happened in Brazil. So in In 2004, Brazil's deforestation rate was sky high. It was at a recent peak. Since 2004, the annual rate of clearing has fallen by more than 80%. And at the same time, the Brazilian economy has expanded. So I recognize the Brazilian economy right now is not doing so great. But if you look at kind of the macro numbers, Brazil greatly increased its agricultural output while also dramatically reducing deforestation. So that really suggested that you can still expand food production and grow your economy without destroying the environment. They're not opposites of each other. And so that's provided a model that Indonesia could potentially follow by shifting agricultural expansion to non-forest lands, having better law enforcement, things like that to disaggregate economic growth from forest destruction.
And you were an economist, were you not?
Well, I wasn't an economist. I mean, my undergraduate degree was in finance and economics. So my approach is a little bit different. I don't have a background as I guess an environmentalist or an ecology. My background's really at looking at the business side of things and how the economics work. And so that's what kind of drives Mongabay in terms of our perspective.
Well, I think we've all got to do a lot more of what you're doing, get the word out. But also as consumers, as citizens, we have to recognize we are global citizens. So, a lot of Americans, Canadians, Westerners don't know much about Indonesia and don't think they have to know about Indonesia. But I think this crisis has brought out that what happens anywhere in the world can affect our sea levels in New England and the growing conditions in California and on and on. We have to know what's happening all over the world.
It's definitely true. I mean, the actions that we take here at home have a big impact, on the other side of the planet. I mean, there's no doubt about it between habitat destruction, climate change, and even rainfall patterns. So, researchers have found these, they call them teleconnections between forests driving moisture to the United States. And so if we lose forests in the Amazon, it could affect rainfall in Chicago. So certainly something to think about.
What are you working on now? Do you have a big project in mind?
Well, Mongabay always has a bunch of projects, but two of our big initiatives right now, one is launching the equivalent of what we have in Indonesia across Spanish-speaking Latin America. So we would have a hub in either Peru or Colombia, and then we have correspondents from Mexico to Argentina and Chile. So broad representation across the region, doing daily news reporting on environmental and conservation issues. So it's obviously a huge market. There's a lot of demand for it, and there's currently not an international Spanish environmental news service that really covers that. So there's monthly services, but doing the same that we've done in Indonesia, which in Indonesia it's just been such a great model. It's been highly successful. We've had the president of Indonesia reference the site. So the goal is to do the same thing in Latin America. The other big new initiative for us is called Wild Tech. It's wildtech.mongabay.com. And it's looking at emerging technology and how it's applied to conservation. So the problem in this space is not that technology, isn't being used. It's that it's not being very well documented. And so there's a lot of hype. And so trying to separate the hype from what actually works. So this site, it's an initiative between Mongabay, a group called Resolve, and World Resources Institute. And there's about 20 scientists involved right now. And so it's field scientists. So really practical insight on what's actually been tried and works in the field, but also what hasn't worked. Because we need to learn from our mistakes as much as we learn from what works. So the site has interviews with practitioners. It has how-tos. It has product reviews, as well as articles and things like that. So we really see it as a platform for disseminating information on how technology can be used in conservation. So that's everything from mobile apps to drones to sensors on the ground to data processing for satellite imagery and things like that.
And Google balloons floating over Indonesia to hook up the net.
Right, exactly. So you need to be connected in a lot of these these applications. So they say it's 3 to 5 years away. I don't know if I believe that, but internet connectivity is definitely important for a lot of these things to work.
We've been talking with Rhett Butler, founder of MongaBay.com. He's become an expert in demand on tropical places and how to communicate what is happening there. You can tell your kids about it with Rhett's photo book, simply called Rainforests. I'll toss some links to all things Rhett Butler in my own blog at ecoshock.info if you missed any during this interview. Be sure and check out his spectacular coverage of the Indonesian fire crisis. Rhett, thank you for joining us, and please come back again.
All right, well, thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith reporting for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.